Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app.
Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the end. Beautiful friend. This is the end. My only friend. The end of our elaborate plans. The end of everything that stands. The end. No safety. The killer awoke before dawn. He put his boots on. He took a face from the ancient gallery and he walked on down the hall. He went into the room where his sister lived and then he paid a visit to his brother and then he walked on down the hall and he came to a door and he looked inside. Father, yes, son, I want to kill you. Mother, I want to.
Heresy shouldn't be this much fun, but it is. It just is, especially when you join Aeon Bite, especially on a Saturday night. Welcome, everybody. Come on, baby. Take a chance on us. Very excited about this show and very excited to see you. My name is Miguel Connor, and I am your pompous of Gnosis. And tonight, we've got a very exciting show and a very important figure whose time has arrived that we shed light into the light of the Pleroma, into his truth, and a truth that is more important than ever to restore the soul of, to restore the soul of this world and the world's soul too. And that is Jim Morrison. So I'm very excited that we are joined by Paul Wilde to discuss a book that you certainly need to have with you right now. And that is Jim Morrison, Secret Teacher of the Occult, A Journey to the Other Side. Paul, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Pleasure is all ours. And again, great book. And with us too, we've got the Moondog Vance. Vance, are you going to light our fire?
Oh, I don't know. I just came out of the soul kitchen.
Baby so roll, baby roll.
All the burners are on. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm glad you're here too, and I'm glad to see already people storming into the chat room. Of course, this is a topic of much interest. Jim Morrison, of course, influenced so many people for so many generations, including myself. I think first time I heard him, I was in the back seat of my dad's car. We were visiting the United States from Mexico, and on the radio came Riders on the Storm. My dad hated rock and roll, but he liked jazz. Somehow he liked this song because he was jamming to it. And I was like terrified as a kid because of the lyrics. And I think that was the first time in my life at 5 years old I knew what existentialism was, if you know what I mean. But of course, later on, his music really saved my ass and fulfilled so many dreams in my life. But we will certainly unpack that and much more. As always, if you have any questions for Paul or comments for Vance and I, please super chat them so we can get to them. Always great if you can support Aeon Byte. Subscribe, share, tell all your friends, or throw some tips out our way. So, Paul, let's talk about you and how you came into this journey. As you write in your book, you had a dark night of the soul, I think around 2016. Do you want to start there, or do you want to start? What was your entrance to the Doors?
Sure. Yeah, in 2016, I moved back to Los Angeles from Boston. And yeah, just in a personal place in my life, you know, you just kind of lost yourself and you want to get back to who you are, you know. At the same time, that was a time in my life where this is where I'm going to take a deep dive into the occult. I mean, I've always been attracted to writers and poets and artists that I realize now more than ever were expressing things that were a part of the Western esoteric tradition. One of the books I discovered in 2016 and really got to reading in 2017 was The Secret Teachers of the Western World by Gary Lachman. This book changed my life. I really did not know exactly what the Western esoteric tradition was. And now I'm convinced that if you want to understand history, you have to be familiar with the Western esoteric tradition. It's a several thousand, you know, year old, you know, spiritual story, and many great figures in history are a part of this. It's a big part of our story. So the more I kept reading this book, the more Jim Morrison came to my mind, until at the end of the book, I had accumulated so many notes in the margins about Jim Morrison. I thought, wow, this is really compelling. I started to say to myself, I think this is the right lens in which to view his life. I think this is the reason why we feel that so many of us feel that he's so much more than just a rock star. What you're getting is a secret teacher, much like all these great figures in the past within the Western esoteric tradition. These people have a very strong connection with that other reality, that unseen reality. And these people have an overpowering desire to express this, you know, as they grow older, because their connection to that world is just so strong. Jim Morrison, his desire to know is just so great that there's no turning away from that calling. And everything about all the secret teachers that I read in Gary Lachman's book are all there in Jim Morrison. It's actually really breathtaking. Mm-hmm. And then I watched Lawrence of Arabia again at a film festival, and I realized that this film also influenced Jim Morrison a great deal. That was my suspicion, and I was able to befriend someone that went to school with him at UCLA. He doesn't want to be named; he just wants to be left out of it. But he confirmed that Jim Morrison did see that movie and that he did love it. Mm. And this is a very esoteric film also about a person that just, you know, T. Lawrence is the first rock star. He goes out into the desert to become somebody else amid the Bedouin tribes. And, you know, he has like a whole new different outfit, and he's photographed by that American journalist. And, you know, it just kind of gave Jim Morrison that, you know, that further inspiration that, you know, you can go off and you can do something different to, you know, fulfill his secret teacher mission. It's an amazing story. And it began with reading Secret Teachers of the Western World.
Yeah, Gary's book is excellent. And I interviewed him back there, 2016, 2017. And yeah, all of Gary's work is just outstanding. Now, I believe that's the book, Paul, where he talks about the poet Petrarch. It's the first time in history that somebody actually went to nature to enjoy it. Before that, humans worshipped in nature and all that, but we pretty much avoided it and all that. And Petrarch was the first person to say, I'm going to go look at the view. You know, it was a complete shift in consciousness where suddenly we weren't just fighting or terrified of nature or worshiping nature. We were just like, This is nice. So, I mean, Gary's books always have, as you know, 20, 30 just gems, just insights and gems. And I agree with you that you make a very good case that Morrison is part of this amazing stream that is really a foundation of human consciousness, the health of humanity, the energy for us to innovate and think outside the box and understand ourselves. But before we get into that, you said you were trying to find yourself again, because obviously that's the journey, right? Sometimes we lose ourselves. We find a, how did you lose yourself? Or what were you trying to get back to in your journey of Lachman and Morrison and all that?
I was in a relationship in Boston. We wanted to start a band, all that, but that didn't work out because this person had other things that were going on. I was just at a place where I need to change cities, and you know, I need to take a real, I need to go inward. And I'd never really done that. You know, we all reach points in our lives, especially as we, you know, approach the middle parts of our lives. You know, we have to go inward. And I think I did what many of us do. We go back to the things that we love to find our child again. And for me, you know, that was reading books. That was just, you know, diving into history and literature and everything that used to make me really tick. And that was my original hook for Jim Morrison. I read No One Here Could Sat Alive in 1983. Mm-hmm. And I saw, hey, this guy loves books too. This guy's an intellectual. You know, Jim Morrison made all that really cool. Suddenly I had, as I say in the first paragraph of my book, I feel like I had a mentor, you know, a guide. So I you know, I started, you know, with Secret Teachers, you know, I started to feel myself just come alive again. I think it did it when I read about Hypatia, the Hellenistic mathematician, right, and what happened to this lady in her lifetime. And I found the movie about her called Agora.
Yeah,
Rachel Weisz plays her. And, you know, the terrible end that she met in the film, that's the only film that like made me cry. Like I was upset for days. That's when I knew I was like, you know, you can learn a lot about yourself by what gets you going, like, you know, what hits big emotions in you. And, you know, that did. That's when I knew that I was feeling vital again. Let's put it that way. And it's interesting story is that I read a book that Gary wrote when he called himself Gary Valentine about leaving New Jersey to go to New York and meeting Chris Stein and Blondie and all that. And he talked about living in a department store, at an abandoned department store with glass everywhere with his guitar. And like that story stuck with me. And it was really cool to find out that Gary Lachman is this Gary Valentine. Are you this guy? You know, Gary's he's very generous. I reached out to him on Facebook to let him know how much I love this book. He was very generous. He was very kind. He was very patient with me. And when I told him I wanted to write this, and I was very fortunate, I got in contact with all the writers that, their books I really loved, and they're all really supportive and generous. I just felt this invisible hand, this invisible force with this.
Right.
You know, I don't want to say like the book wrote itself. I had to work pretty hard, but it was almost as if the spirit's like, if you work hard, we're going to lay the breadcrumbs out there for you. You know, this was a very, I could write a book about writing this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And the great movie. I liked Hypatia. Yeah, speaking of going back to Jim Morrison, I think one of my moments was Apocalypse Now, the beginning, right? Remember with Martin Sheen playing the end, and there's the fire, and Martin Sheen is struggling with alcoholism and PTSD. It was one of the greatest scenes I've ever seen in movie theater, and it just hits it. The shadow side of our country, the shadow side of the American dream. It was a very powerful scene to me. And
that's just, right. He was having a nervous breakdown right there on the camera.
Right. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Cause there's the whole movie, the documentary about the Heart of Darkness, of course. And I had read The Heart of Darkness before watching the end. So, I mean, before watching Apocalypse Now, so it was double powerful, but that just tells you how well Jim Morrison's magic just fits, defines an age and all that. And if somebody,
Jim Morrison he was in film school when Francis Ford Coppola was there.
Really? Wow.
Yes. Jim Morrison was at UCLA. A lot of his classmates and his teachers were just amazing artists in the realm of film and experimental film too.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Yeah. He was, definitely had his hands in a lot of things. And when individuals ask you about the Western esoteric tradition, again, they're not familiar with Gary Lachman. They're more into Jim Morrison. What do you tell them? Because a lot of people, what is this guy talking? People know occultism and mysticism, but what is the Western esoteric tradition?
So the Western esoteric tradition, as I understand and have learned from Gary Lachman, and then later from a book that Jim Morrison found in high school called The History of Magic and the Occult, written by Kurt Seligman.
Right.
And also from Colin Wilson's 1971 book, The Occult. All three of these books are excellent if you want to learn about the Western esoteric tradition. It's, you know, in a nutshell, a really exciting and very thrilling story of people who are part of something that they've created over time called the rejected knowledge, what the poet Robert Graves also calls the lunar knowledge. And these are people who are in touch, you know, with another reality, you know, the unseen world. I kind of, it's a little difficult to explain to people who are not really too spiritual and not right, waking up, so to speak. And a good way to understand this is there's a scene, if you've seen the movie, The Thin Red Line. Mm-hmm. In the beginning of the movie, there's a scene with Sean Penn and I forget the other actor, but he plays a character called Wit. Jim Cazaville, did I pronounce his name?
Yeah.
And he tells Sean Penn that, you know, that there's another world that he's seen, that sometimes he feels like it's just his imagination. And what he's saying is actually true. Like, you need your imagination or to make that other unseen, other reality vivid, you know, vivid for yourself, because it is there. And that's, you know, that's the function of the imagination. I mean, Gary has another, you know, book about this as well.
Right.
So that is a good way to explain this to people, is that it's a history of people that have their activation, their imaginations have been activated, have been come alive by, you know, contact, you know, with an unseen world, with the unseen reality. And these are people who they get into trouble, you know, for expressing this, at, you know, sometimes, you know, it's especially during like the Inquisition, you know, during ancient Roman times, you know, in the 1960s, they went after Jim Morrison. You know, he didn't expose himself in Miami. What happened is that they found something to nail him with, because the idea was to get him convicted and send him. My strong belief is that the idea was to get him convicted and then have him sent to Rayford Prison, where he can be easily killed. I really believe that that was the goal, because when you look at his story through the lens, the Western esoteric tradition and what all past secret teachers have gone through, they're very similar to Jim Morrison's story, where in the end, you know, they're executed, they're jailed, they're tortured, they're silenced. And in Jim Morrison's day, you know, J. Edgar Hoover and Nixon and all of them, they were not keen on having the son of one of America's most outstanding military officers turn America's baby boomers onto cosmic consciousness and divine reality and their divine self. Because when you do that, you lose power over people. You lose power over their minds. You become an autonomous, you know, an autonomous person. And Jim Morrison was all about freedom. All about freedom. And just like Giordano Bruno, the Italian mathematician who took a chance on going back to Italy when he thought they forgot about him, he went back to Italy in the early 1590s, and he had a falling out with his patron, and they arrested him, and the Inquisition got him, and they jailed him for many years, and they executed him in 1600.
Right.
You know, Jim Morrison in Paris, you know, he's convicted. See, I really had to walk with this person. You know, he goes to Paris in March 1971 to find himself again, start writing poetry again. But hanging over his head is this conviction, because he's still on bond with his appeal. His lawyers are telling him there's a great chance that he's going to get off on appeal. Mm-hmm. But you've already been convicted of something that you did not do. So it's, you know, I'm certain, I would just bet my life that Jim Morrison is in Paris, and he's actually asking people, like, I want some kind of assurance that if I'm convicted, if I lose on the appeal, I'm not going to end up doing 6 months of hard labor in Rayford Prison in Florida. Of course, nobody can guarantee him that. Mm-hmm. So you're Jim Morrison, and you just don't know what's going to happen to you. You know, when you go back to America, do you take a chance on that? You know, France doesn't have an extradition treaty with the United States. I mean, that's why Roman Polanski stays there, right? Right. So, you know, now, Jim Morrison could have just stayed there. Now, John Densmore said it, you know, it was possible that he probably just disappeared because of this.
Right.
So this is the pattern with secret teachers, you know, in the Western esoteric tradition. And you know, when I tried to, you know, explain this to people, then the absolute, you know, to my astonishment, my great surprise, is that in Jim Morrison, we have one of these people that comes along every 100-150 years in the form of a rock star. I mean, if you want to learn about this, all you have to do is go online and YouTube and all these things and learn all about Jim Morrison's life. And you're going to learn about a secret teacher, a person who gets, they overcome their fear mm-hmm. of what society is going to think about them and expressing what is going on with them. And then they make their own path. And in Jim Morrison's case, as in all the cases of these other secret teachers, it's like a double-edged sword. There's not like a double-edged sword, but the conditions out there in society that are, there's just enough going on in the 60s where everybody's receptive to a person like Jim Morrison. That's the time of the world's first popular cult awakening, right? Mm-hmm. But there's still also just enough in the culture that's very conservative that doesn't want this to happen either, that went after him.
That's very true.
So when the Western esoteric tradition flowed through Jim Morrison like a raging river. And there's so many different tributaries off that river that are intellectually and spiritually and artistically very rich, really magnificent, you know, with very long, you know, traditions behind them. And the 60s seem to embody a lot of the Renaissance epics in the Western esoteric tradition. And Jim Morrison seems to embody a lot of what those past secret teachers had as well. It's almost like things just sort of like they really coalesced at that time. It wasn't just the birth of rock and roll that Jim Morrison said that, you know, he was his coming of age was coincidental with. He was also coincidental with the world's first occult awakening. Mm-hmm. And that this to me is the core of Jim Morrison's story. You know, with that Doors film by Oliver Stone. I like his other movies. This movie has a lot of problems because there's a lot of things in his film that are not correct.
Correct.
I became friends with Bill Cosgrave, who lived with Jim Morrison for a couple of years here in Los Angeles at UCLA mm-hmm. during his time at UCLA and performing the Doors. He was also friends with Jim Morrison's girlfriend, Mary Werbelow. When Mary saw the film, she said that's only 15 to 20% of Jim. The rest of him is just not there.
Right.
So hopefully there'll be a reprise of his life, you know, out there in the future. Jim Morrison hated Hollywood. He called it syrup for the masses. So it's kind of sad that, you know, there's a Hollywood movie that's misrepresenting his life this way. Ray Manzarek hated this film. He hated it so much that he got into Oliver Stone's face about it on set. And Oliver Stone threw him off the set, banned him from the set. And then this caused Ray Manzarek to go off and to make another documentary about Jim Morrison.
Wow, that's incredible. Yeah, I mean, what was I going to say? Just unpacking a little bit of what you're, or piggybacking of what you're saying. I remember when he was, the issue in Miami and all that, and he was an interview, and he's like, look, I'm a rich rock star. I can throw money at this thing, and I've thrown a lot of money, which is insane. It's supposed to be a just society, but he felt bad because he's like, there's all these black people who don't have my money and they're getting thrown in jail for 20, 30 years. So he had a sense of empathy and justice in the late early 70s when he was already, you know, richest and famous and godlike with the public. So, and it's interesting about the film, the Oliver Stone film, as I always thought, Val Kilmer was sort of miscast to begin with. I always thought they should have put Jason Patrick from The Lost Boys. He looked more like Jim Morrison. Of course, ironic, The Lost Boys has that song by Echo and the Bunnymen, the cover, When You're Strange, and they do a great job. It's one of the few times when somebody did a Doors cover that was good, that didn't suck, because it's hard to replicate. Eddie Vedder and all these singers, of course, a whole generation replicates Jim Morrison, but the Doors sound and that essence, Scott Whelan, of course, of Stone Temple Pilots, he never was trying to copy Eddie Vedder. He was, you know, years before he was trying to copy Jim Morrison. So It's just throwing some interesting stuff there too. But why don't we unpack a little bit about the influences of Jim so we can try to understand? I mean, it seems when he was a kid, he saw a horrible accident with some natives. And that really changed his psyche, didn't it, Paul? I mean, that was a huge pivotal time in his life.
He considered, so this that moment in his life to be the most significant moment in his life. So that the experience when he was 3 years old, his family was on a trip in northern New Mexico, a road trip. Mm-hmm. And they came across this is huge, you know, Doors mythology, right? They came across an accident of dying Native American workers. And Jim Morrison told his friends on the set while they were making his film Highway and American Pastoral that he felt that the souls of one or two of those dying Native workers, you know, had leaped into his and remained there for his entire life. It does fit a pattern with shamans when they're young, that there's a spiritual transference, there's a spiritual indwelling that takes place that stays with them. I have read this in Richie Elias' Shamanism, Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy.
Yeah.
This book was translated to English in 1964, and I'm sure Jim Morrison read it. I'm sure there was a copy available at UCLA where Carlos Castaneda was teaching, et cetera, and so forth.
Right.
So there's much more to this, though. There's much, much more to that story is what surrounds it. That's how I begin the book. The Los Alamos National Laboratory, you know, the home of the Manhattan Project where the atom bomb was created, that used to be called the Los Alamos Ranch School for Boys. And that's where William S. Burroughs, the beat writer, went to school as a kid.
Right.
And he felt that he liked the idea, kind of fun, like a novel, kind of fun, that that's the place where Oppenheimer came later on and turned it into Los Alamos. Because Oppenheimer was also a student there when he was a kid. And General Groves put Oppenheimer in charge of the Manhattan Project and said, you know, find a place where we can do this. And he remembered northern New Mexico there when he was a boy. So the Army or the American military at the time, they went to that place and they bought the school. And in April 1943, that's when Oppenheimer convened a scientist to begin the Manhattan Project. Also in April 1943, that is when Albert Hofmann accidentally doused his hand with the LSD that he had discovered 5 years earlier and kept on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a very interesting, you know, bike ride home. And that's how I start the book, because in a spiritual sense, you know, we're developing this weapon that we can destroy ourselves. And it's almost like, you know, LSD is something given to us that can accelerate, you know, our spiritual look at the world. There's so many people that have had, you know, life-changing, life-altering, life-transformative experiences with LSD. Many have become, you know, Christians or cultists or mystics, or they've gone into like protecting the environment. And it really changes their outlook on life. It spurs them on towards, you know, cosmic consciousness. Now, you don't need LSD for that, but it almost seems like it's divinely appeared at the same time that, you know, we developed this terrible weapon. And then into this picture, you know, Jim Morrison was also born in 1943. And then 3 years later, these Native American workers were the ones who were recruited in the area to build Los Alamos National Laboratory into a permanent installation. They thought that it was just, they call it the lab on the hill, and they thought it was just there temporarily. At the time, nobody knew what it was for. But after the bomb went off, they was like, wow, like that's where they built it. And the natives were not happy about that, you know. They're not happy with this weapon that was created on their sacred lands. And you can imagine how they feel about that. So with Jim Morrison, it's almost as if the spirit world came to him. They came to this young person who is the son of this great military commander, and I write in the book, it's almost like they implanted in him that fighting warrior spirit for all that is sacred with the land and the world and with that other reality that, you know, we can't lose. I tried, when I wrote the book, I didn't want to explain Jim Morrison because that's just impossible. Right. At the beginning of the history of magic and the occult, which we'll get to, that Morrison found when he was a teenager, Kurt Seligman chose the opening quote for that book from Albert Einstein. The fairest thing that we can experience is the mysterious. And I think one of the genius things about Jim Morrison was he was able to artistically appropriate his powerful sense of mystery, you know, artistically with rock. So I wanted, you know, the book to unfold in a way that just kind of leaves you breathtaking, like with all these synchronicities and these affinities and all these parallels, you know? And I think what happened in New Mexico was one of the deeply mysterious things about it is that the spirit world came to Jim Morrison so young, and after doing my research, you know, I agree with Jim Morrison. I think there was a spiritual indwelling that took place, and they did stay with him, you know, for his life, because there's so many clues to a person going through a spiritual awakening that you find in all the biographies. I came across a book called The Stormy Search for Self by Christine and Stanislav Grof, which is like probably the best book written about spiritual awakening. And everything they talk about in that book that people go through, it's all there in all the biographies about Jim Morrison's life as a teenager and going through college. This person was searching. This person was seeking. This person was being affected by the spiritual world. This person was journaling constantly to understand themselves this way. He had two girlfriends, and Tandy Martin and Mary Werbelow, that were spiritually concerned about him. One took him to a Presbyterian minister. The other took him to a church in Florida, you know, to pray, to ask God to show Jim that he's real, that God is real. And they had this incredible experience in a Florida church that terrified him. This light that was like, you know, expanding in the church, that they ran out terrified. And Mary Werbelow believes that her prayers were answered. And Jim Morrison said that, you know, I don't know what that was, but it was real. And that experience in that church haunted him as much as the experience with the dying Native American Indians. You can read his poetry, you know, "Thank you, O Lord, for the white blind light." This person had just extraordinary, these are two extraordinary spiritual experiences.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Jim Morrison was, we're talking about somebody who was a very spiritual person. Bill Siddons, their manager, said, you know, his concerns are of another world, not of mine. He did not get into rock and roll to get rich. He did not get into rock and roll to have houses and things and material stuff and status and look at me and narcissism. No. This person, like every past secret teacher, was looking for a way to express themselves, to get other people to see and feel what he was seeing and feeling. And since Jim Morrison was really brilliant and very creative, he saw that rock and roll was a new way to do that. If rock and roll hadn't existed, he would have turned, you know, to experimental filmmaking, which is why he went to UCLA in the first place. Right. You know, painting and poetry, of course. He was a great poet. But rock and roll, he saw it as a way, especially with his, you know, being so rooted in primitivism, being so old that way, along with shamanism, you know, gave him the vehicle to open up this way. So with Jim Morrison, you get, you know, four different huge aspects live. You get, you know, the Dionysian, you know, celebrating life and pain with the music. And, you know, you get the secret teacher through, like, coming out, you know, with shamanism and waking up to the unseen, the spirit world. You know, you get the theater of the cruelty and the absurd, Antonin Artaud, which is to shock the audience and really get their participation in. And also it's like Bosch Lock, where, you know, Jim Morrison's favorite artist is Hieronymus Bosch. He stood in front of the Garden of Earthly Delights, that painting in the Prado in Spain, for hours and hours when he was there with his girlfriend. You know, when you look at this painting, there's, like, you know, one part of the triptych is, you know, they're in the garden and everybody's like naked and all that. And the other part, it's like hell, they're all being tortured. It's, you know, it's pleasure and pain, right? And Jim Morrison, like, even looks like a figure in a Hieronymus Bosch painting, like the way he carries himself on stage. So you have all of these things coming out and coalescing in Jim Morrison, right? And, you know, the core of that is that spiritual center. So with to go back to the shamanism, you know, from the desert, that's extremely mysterious. And of course, shamanism is you know, a shaman is a person who heals the tribe,
right?
With their techniques of ecstasy. And Jim Morrison's technique for ecstasy was, you know, rock and roll, you know, John Densmore behind him with the drums. Now, Jim Morrison got very, very lucky. John Densmore and Ray Manzarek and Robert Krieger, absolutely fantastic musicians.
Yeah.
There's no band that's going to ever sound like the Doors, right? You have John Densmore back there with those drums while Jim is in his like shamanic paroxysms. And people in the audience, they did feel a sense of like a spiritual communalism, a kind of telepathy. At the same time, when they were interviewed, most of them said, I have no idea what I just saw, but I know I saw something that I'm going to be thinking about for like a really long time. I mean, you're not going to get instant spiritual enlightenment like going to see the Doors, but Jim Morrison really appropriated his energy to wake people up. So he screams, wake up. Like you wake up at a Doors concert, right?
Mm-hmm. Very true. And I'm glad he picked rock and roll, because as I write in my Elvis book, people still or have forgotten that rock music really started out as a spiritual movement. Johnny Cash, Elvis, Little Richard, these guys were Pentecostals and they were doing Revival 10 stuff. And as scholars have noted, Pentecostalism is just Christian shamanism. Then it got commercialized. But then I think Jim really could tap into that primordial snake handling, we're going to hell kind of vibe. And he really innovated it. And of course, as you write in your book, and it's no secret, Jim was very influenced by Elvis, his singing. He liked the crooners, but Elvis was a big influence on him. And I'm also working on a David Bowie book, speaking of another shaman, except he's more science fiction. But it's interesting how they had the similar influences, Paul, because both David, like Jim, was very influenced by Colin Wilson and Jack Kerouac. And some of the similar sort of the counterculture stuff that was out there at the time. I mean, that was really big with Jim for his waking up, too. Again, Faculty X, the new existentialism, all that stuff that also blew Bowie away. William Burroughs. All that vibe.
Yes. When you speak of Faculty X, that's basically an idea that Colin Wilson came up with in 1966 when he was working in Washington State in America. It's basically like you go down like a time pocket where you basically feel very connected, like you're reliving certain historical events. You know, Arnold Toynbee, the great historian, has many experiences like this that he's written about. You know, with Jim Morrison, like you get a Faculty X experience because you're taken right back into ancient times. Right. Jim Morrison was a very, very old soul. And he was all about things that were very, very old, you know, like shamanism and, you know, ancient Egypt. Like ancient Egypt didn't have religion. Ancient Egyptians were religion. Mm-hmm. They saw their land as a reflection of heaven, the land of Hermes Trismegistus, the land of as above, so below. You know, these people, but like, you know, cosmic consciousness wasn't an intellectual idea to find in reality. They were that. These people were living in cosmic consciousness. So with Jim Morrison, it becomes like a collective Faculty X that happens in Doors concerts. I imagine just hanging around him and being around him is to feel all of these things as well. With Faculty X, it's a heightening of reality of the world. And Colin Wilson makes light of Van Gogh's painting, The Starry Night, like it becomes just so alive. It's intertwined also with something called having peak experiences, which I think Jim Morrison had many, many of them. I want to go back to Elvis because this is really important, because Jim Morrison really loved Elvis. I came across a video, a man named Ed Martin, who was a roommate of his at FSU, and Jim Morrison gave him his copy of The History of Magic and the Occult, 1963, wrote in the book, you know, for Christmas. And I learned about this because he was auctioning it off at an auction, and it's on YouTube. And I immediately knew there's a connection between that book and what I just wrote. Mm-hmm. So with a lot of the things that, you know, that Elvis is into, you know, they're very similar to what's going on in this book. And with the whole, I think the leather clad image that Elvis had helped to give Jim Morrison an idea to form the idea of the Lizard King. Because, you know, the Lizard King is like, you know, the lizard is very ancient. It's like, it's very, very old. So it's a projection of the things that he's trying to bring back, and all wrapped up in this whole idea of like Faculty X, you know, and everything like that. But to go back to what I said about Ed Martin, when they lived together, sometimes he had to go into Jim's room to turn down the transistor radio because he would wait up all night for a show in which they played nothing but Elvis songs.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. He really loved Elvis Presley. Jim Morrison, as a teenager, would go around Alexandria, Virginia, to all the blues bars and out of the way places to hear the music. And that seems to be what Elvis did also as a child.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us if, as an aside, like, because this is really important, if the new film about Elvis, how do you feel about that film, or what's true, what's not true as it relates to all this?
Oh dear, I like what Baz Luhrmann did. He tried to squeeze it all in 2 hours, and he did a really good job. He obviously completely missed over Elvis's spirituality, Yogananda, occultism, studying Hermeticism, astrology, and all that. That he kind of threw that out, but I like the beginning about how much blues and gospel and Captain Marvel really affected Elvis's mind and so forth. And I think there's a lot, the abuse that he doesn't talk about with his mother, which I talk about in my book, very Oedipus. I think Jim had a problem with his father. I think that messed his head up. Elvis, it was his mother. And I don't think either one ever, Bowie too, his mother just effed his head up. And I don't think all three of them ever got over this archetypal kind of stuff, but that was glossed over. And a lot of scenes, yeah, are very fictional. Elvis never called out the colonel out in this. And he never, he was almost arrested a few times. And yes, the FBI, like Morrison, had a file on him. And, you know, the government was gunning. People forget how much, yes, the country loved Elvis, but there was part of the country that despised him and thought he was an existential threat. And there was never, he was threatened a few times by a judge that if you shake your hips or say this, you're going to get thrown in jail. And Elvis would just get up on stage and do this and talk shit about the judge, but he kept it pretty clean. So all in all, I think it's a pretty decent movie, Paul. Yeah. But again, there's just no way. There's so much about Elvis. You couldn't do it in a two. Just like, same with The Doors, the movie with Oliver Stone. You can do 15%, 10% if you're lucky. You know, it's just, that's how it is too. And
so when Jim, sure, go ahead. No, I was going to say, when Jim Morrison started college in St. Petersburg, Florida, when he's going to St. Petersburg Community College, which is where he met Mary Werbelow, he would go to the, you know, the weird out of the way clubs around there too. And that's where he met a bar owner who said that, you know, you have the same it factor that Elvis Presley has.
Mm-hmm.
And that might have been something that stuck with Jim Morrison when he told him that, was, you know, Jim Morrison did have that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. He definitely had that. Yeah. Definitely an it factor. And again, both guys were very spiritual. Elvis was very, you know, for him it was all about seeking God, understanding, like Jim, he was obsessed with death because of the death of his brother at birth. You know, he loved native lore. I mean, there's a lot of parallels when I read your book and my book on Elvis too, which is uncanny. But again, sometimes fate does that. And as they say, as Paul Levy says, the wounded healer is the best shaman. And that's unfortunate. It's the broken ones that can heal because they're in so much pain. They know how to heal others. And unfortunately, Jim, Elvis, and even David Bowie was a very broken person, but that's, they let this power come in. because half of them is already in the land of the spirits, the land of the dead. So you make a good case. Even Paul, you talk about how he was into alchemy. And I love this quote. You quote his journal where he says, alchemy offers man an original heroism. So he already knew about alchemy and the transformation and all that. I mean, and of course, as you say, he read Joseph Campbell, he knew Castañeda. I mean, he knew all this Western esoteric shamanistic power, and he did something with it. He alchemized it to express an art to the world. And like you said, the Lizard King and Dionysus, what do you think? The Lizard King, and that's based on Dionysus, right? Because the serpent is associated with Dionysus, and he probably embraced that archetype too far, don't you think? As they say, you have to be careful with these archetypes, because if these gods possess you, sometimes they don't let go, right, Paul? If you invite them in.
That's true. I do. You just brought that up. That recalls something I wrote in the book about when one day he goes to Ray Manzarek and he says, listen, I don't know if I want to do this. You know, I don't know if I want to carry on with this. And they were just beginning to get famous. And Ray Manzarek looked at him like, you're crazy. Like, don't toss this now, you know? And Jim Morrison said, I don't know. You know, that could be, one of the things is that he was feeling that, it's one thing to write about all these things and to feel all these things. It's another to become an avatar in your culture for the awakening of the spirit world this way. And I think he had second thoughts, but Jim Morrison had lots of second thoughts about a lot of different things that were going on at that time. Mm-hmm. It's kind of reflective of a scene in Lawrence of Arabia. I wrote this in my book, in which T.E. Lawrence, he tells General Allenby, like, I don't want to go back out there. I'm done. General Alvin says, listen, not too many people have a destiny. It'd be a terrible thing for a man to flunk it if he has. And Ray Manzarek more or less told Jim Morrison the same thing. Like, this, your destiny is basically unfolding, with the doors, it's rock and roll. Jim Morrison was very lucky to meet Mayor Manzarek. Ray Manzarek was the one who saw the genius in Jim Morrison. He saw the talent. He saw the potential. But even more than that, Ray Manzarek saw the spiritual person. And Ray Manzarek had a really unified idea about what was going on in the world and could see how Jim Morrison had a place in it. So, that's kind of like it's kind of like a Horatio figure in Jim Morrison's life, as well as an older dad type person. Mm-hmm. But I'd say it's more like an Horatio figure. I see Jim Morrison as a Hamlet figure just because I really think Hamlet predates Modern Man by 300 years, because this is a play in which the main character wakes up to the spirit world and it dramatically changes his life and it shocks him out of his grief. Aside from learning that, your mother and your uncle murdered your father, to become the rulers of Denmark. He goes to Horatio and says, there's more things that are in this world that are dreamt of in your philosophy. He's very excited. I'm recalling the Mel Gibson scene, from the film.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he looks at Horatio, let's just give it a welcome. And that's what Jim Morrison did. He gave it a welcome. That's what everybody back then was doing, giving it a welcome in the 1960s. This is coming back again. We're giving it a welcome all over again. We're all Hamlets this way. We all are engaged with communication with spirits. We have spirit guides and angel numbers going on and all of these things. That we've given it a welcome. We have yet to see where all this is going to be, so to speak. But I'm generally convinced it's part of our evolution. And that's the big story about Jim Morrison with the Western esoteric tradition. He's not just a secret teacher. He's one of the big ones. Because he's just out there in front of many, many people expressing all this. And here we are 50 years later talking about him. 50 years from now, they're going to talk about him, and they're going to talk about him in the same way that we talk about all the other past secret teachers because of this. Mm-hmm. Because it's just such a momentous moment in human history. And in the late 1800s, you have this first, these people like Aleister Crowley and Madame Blavatsky and Rudolf Steiner, et cetera. They're starting to be fearless about their beliefs and about the other reality. Then you have World War One and World War Two, and it kind of goes under. Mm-hmm. In the 50s, everyone is just trying to recover from the war. Then the 60s, it just explodes. You know, suddenly everybody is doing what those people did in the late 1800s. You know, now it's exploding even more. It's not, renaissances are no longer like around a city, mm-hmm. like Florence or Alexandria, San Francisco, New York or Paris. You know, we have cyberspace. So there's a renaissance taking place on cyberspace, such as conversations like this that are happening all over the world. So this is something that is becoming global.
Agreed.
I think a reason why it's important that, one of the reasons why I felt it was important to write this book is, you know, for, as people are going through spiritual awakenings, they can share, they're discovering the doors. They can see that, you know, what Jim Morrison is going through reflects a lot about what they're going through. You can learn a lot from Jim Morrison about all of this stuff. And you can learn a lot about what's happening, you know, in the world right now. And you talked about Petrarch and Mount Vento and, you know, in the 1300s, he goes to the top. And so Jean Gebzer, he wrote The Ever-Present Origin, and Gary Lachman talks about it in The Secret Teachings of the Western World. That's how I discovered the whole structures of consciousness. So when Petrarch climbs that mountain, Gebzer sees that as the beginning of the breakdown of the mental rational structure of consciousness. Because Petrarch goes up there and he, you know, he works hard to get to the summit. Many people discouraged him from climbing that mountain, like, you know, people have died, etc. He wasn't prepared for how that view was going to affect him when he got to the top. Like it just really changed, and it haunted him for the rest of his life. And he goes back down and he writes in his journals, and of course he feels, you know, guilt and shame because it's a worldly experience, and you know, all that sort of, you know, religious Christian stuff, right, that was going on back then in the Roman Catholic Church. It really, really changes. And now we're moving into something called the integral structure of consciousness, which unites all those past structures of consciousness. And I think that's what Jim Morrison was poetically expressing when he said, you know, let's reinvent all the gods, all the myths of the ages, you know, celebrate symbols from deep elder forests. That is a beautiful poetic expression of an integral structure of consciousness that unites the archaic, the magical, the mythical, and the mental rational, you know, all, you know, coming together. I think Jim Morrison detected the same kind of change in consciousness through all of his reading and all of his journaling that Jean Gebzer did when he came across a Rilke's poetry. That's what cued him in, that there's a great change in consciousness that was happening. Jim Morrison, he witnessed an actual renaissance. Like when he was, he began his high school years in Alameda. And across the bay, that's where Lawrence Ferlinghetti Getty had, you know, his City Lights books. Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg and Michael McClure were all present when Ginsberg read Howl in 1955. That was organized by Lawrence Ferlinghetti Getty. Jim Morrison had this friend with a funny name, Fudd Ford. They'd go into town and hang out at City Lights books. And even in No One Here Gets Out Alive, you read that Jim Morrison, like, was so freaked out when he met Lawrence Ferlinghetti Getty that he ran off, right? So, you know, all that was going on back then. You know, Michael McClure was the one. So Jim was really lucky to meet Ray Manzarek for Rock and Roll. But with his poetry, Jim Morrison was very lucky to become friends with Michael McClure. It was Michael McClure who discovered his poems, like, thought they were just beautiful and amazing and should be published. And when Jim Morrison received his book from Simon & Schuster, The Lords and the New Creatures, you know, he was practically in tears. And he looked at Michael McClure and said, "This is the first time I don't feel like I've ever been fucked over." But that was his dream, to have his poems published that way.
Yeah, he's a great poet. His poetry could stand alone easily without the music. I want to get to Vince in a second, but I want to deal with something, because every time at the corner of my eye I look at the chat, if I see CIA or MK Ultra one more time, I'm going to scream, because Jim Morrison triggers people. But I'm sure you're familiar with David McGowan's book, right? And the idea that obviously Jim Morrison's father was in charge of one of the greatest false flag operations. And so now it's become trendy to think that Jim might have been a creation of his father to corrupt. Have you heard that conspiracy, Paul?
Yes. So let's talk about this for a minute. Let's go down this rabbit hole for a moment. So I was unfortunate enough to become friends with a man named Tom O'Neill. We met at a bus stop one night. We recognized each other here in West LA.
Chaos?
Yeah, Chaos.
Oh, wow.
And actually, the story is that I met someone that was friends with him, and they wanted to introduce us. And then he told me to watch his show with Joe Rogan, where he talks about MK Ultra, which is extremely fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I was waiting for the bus one night. It was just him there at the bus stop at the Grove here in West Hollywood, and I recognized him at the Joe Rogan show. I'm like, are you Tom O'Neill? He's like, are you Paul Wilde? And that's how we met. So
hey, that book is a synchronicity. It gets it's an accident.
Yes. It took Tom 20 years to write that book, and I think it's the most responsible, most informative, most mature book that has been published about MK Ultra.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of rock stars have, you know, military fathers, you know, like David Crosby, and I think he did, or, you know, others, and et cetera.
Frank Zappa.
And much has been made about this, you know, this army military base, whatever, that was located in Laurel Canyon, et cetera, and so forth.
That's it.
So the core, one of the cores of MKUltra before that was, when the CIA got a hold of LSD, they tried to turn it into a truth serum. It didn't work. You know what was happening? Their agents were leaving the agency. They discovered God. They wanted nothing to do with it. And then they tried the same. That's right. They tried the same thing with those with using prostitutes to lure men into the hotel rooms in San Francisco to study them to see how LSD and, you know, controlling people, you know, could have benefited them this way. Now, one of the ironies is that America's top spy after World War II, I forget his name, he became a big champion of the spiritual aspects of LSD. And he introduced the actor Cary Grant to LSD. And Cary Grant had, like, you know, 60 LSD trips that said really helped change him, helped him.
Yeah, Cary Grant had a horrible childhood, too. So good, yeah.
LSD was used to great success with alcoholics, you know, in Canada.
The founder of AA, went to LSD treatment. Yeah, you're right.
That's right. It was outlawed in California October 6, 1966. Jim Morrison bought tons and tons of LSD when you can buy it legally over the counter. So it didn't have the desired use that the CIA was looking. So after World War II, they were looking for all this kind of stuff to see how they can create something that's based on mind control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the crux of everything that goes on with MK Ultra. I mean, Richard Helms and all those people, and, you know, all that material that came to light in the 1970s. That's still, I think, mysterious. I still think we haven't gotten down to the bottom of that. I do think Tom O'Neill's book, you know, Chaos, is a really big step on that ladder, you know, with it. But I don't think Jim Morrison at all was any kind of mind controlled, you know, person whatsoever. This is a person who, like all secret teachers, they guarded their mind. They had statements in their, he had statements in his poetry, like, you know, do you know that we are ruled by TV? And Jim Morrison was very, very aware of the power of television, the power of the media, the power of all those forces that, you know, that can control the mind. And he saw, I think what happened with Jim Morrison is that you can tell Notes on Vision, the first part of his poetry book, mm-hmm. you know, where he talks a lot about alchemy. There are very astute observations with alchemy's relationship with experimental cinema. And then at the end of Notes on Vision, you suddenly have these thoughts about shamanism, and he sees shamanism, you know, as a way that can heal people. It's a technique that needs to come back, in that it can, you know, reawaken us back, you know, to our divine selves and the spiritual realm, and, you know, where we're at right now. And it kind of appears in Notes on Vision as like the answer, you know, the clue, you know, the way to do things. And he said later, you can read this in the Collector's of Jim Morrison. He said when he wrote that, he didn't realize that just, you know, two or three years later, he'd be doing exactly that with the Doors. There is nothing about Jim Morrison that is mind control. There isn't anything about Jim Morrison that is satanic. There isn't anything about Jim Morrison that is, you know, rebel angels, demonic angels, all these kinds of things, you know, controlling his life, all of this stuff. He was someone who was interested in the dark side of life, but in a way that has more to do with shadow work than anything else. Like a lot of the Doors is like Jim Morrison, but going through shadow work and all those types of things.
You know, yeah, writing about serial killers and murders. Yeah, it's normal. People do it in podcasts every day.
That's right. I mean, with Jim Morrison, you get someone, it's not just like, you know, peace, love, and flowers and all that, like back then. But with Jim Morrison, like, he was looking at all aspects of life. Now, it wasn't just like, you know, joyful and happy and everything like that. Like, you know, life is very dark and it's very tragic. And it's like James Joyce said, like, life is filled with joy and terror. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what the Doors are. The Doors music is filled with joy and terror, you know. And Jim Morrison was very aware of all of that. But no, Jim Morrison was not an MK Ultra mind controlled rock star.
Yeah, somebody in the chat, Jim worship Dionysus. I gotta put this up. Whom is the devil? All right, we got a live one here. Yes, sure, Dionysus is Satan. Yes, yes. That's a complete lack of understanding of religion, mythology, and just theology in general. But you do you, man. Vance, do you have any questions? Or are you MK Ultra now?
Well, I'm going to sound like MK Ultra. I don't think Jim Morrison was hooked up with the CIA. His life was too chaotic. But although you may disagree with me, Paul, that his life was chaotic. But I grew up in the 60s. I played the Doors music in my high school rock band and all that stuff. And I always felt that I enjoyed the music and the lyrics a little bit because it was different. You know, it wasn't the same old British invasion stuff. It was more... I don't know, it was more melodic and so forth. The music wasn't chaotic, and a lot of the music that would come later on, 60s, 70s, would become chaotic. But I have trouble, and please try to explain this to me. Maybe you can quote some lyrics or something. But why he was a teacher? Because it seemed to me that his life, I think you've convinced me that he had a big spiritual side, and I'm sure it came out in the poetry and so forth and some of the lyrics. But his early death and the way he treated his life, his own life, didn't seem to me to be a good example or something where he was deliberately teaching. I suppose he could learn a lot by studying him, as you have. But how was he a teacher? You know, like Manly Hall was a teacher, or, you know, Madame Blavatsky was a teacher.
That's a really great question.
Hey, shining crazy diamonds. Please subscribe for the second part of this interview. It certainly helps grow this Red Pill cafeteria. What's more, beyond getting the second half, you get content earlier and don't have to worry about flapdoodle commercials here or on other public platforms. So please become a Red Circle sub, Patreon, or AB Prime member for the full consciousness expanding gnosis. At Patreon, I have tiers as low as $1 or $3 a month. And at Red Circle, it's a clean $4.99 a month to stream all full shows. All subs include a dedicated private stream that works on most apps. Don't forget the Gnostic Tarot, which is selling well and optimizing spiritual growth based on the feedback I've gotten. And the Virtual Alexandria Academy. I can't do it without you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.